I would like to introduce Marianne Graham, PhD and
LISW.
She has been a faculty member at the University of St. Thomas since 1993. She's a former MSW program director and a member of the Spirituality Institute and chief diversity officer for the university. She teaches graduate policy, practice, and research courses, including an elective that she developed called The Spiritual Dimension of Social Work Practice. She's noted for her engaging style and passion for critical thinking. And some for music.
Thank you.
So let's begin with a bit of a conventional or unconventional prayer. I'm going to ask you to join me. It's real simple. Wisdom, compassion, love, understanding. Can you say that one?
Wisdom, compassion, love, understanding.
Again.
Wisdom, compassion, love, understanding, come be in my heart, come be in my hands, come be in my feet, come be in my working and playing, the words I am saying. My laughing, my crying, my living, my dying. Come be in my heart, Holy One, wisdom, compassion, love, understanding, wisdom, compassion,
Integral Ethics. Hope you're all in the right place. You came to this one on purpose. To the next. So, any good workshop has its objectives, and here are ours. I'm not going to stand here and read them to you. Instead, I want to begin by saying that social workers are certainly aware that as humans, we each have individual experiences, both internal and external, based on the unique individuals that we are, and we also have experiences as members of many different groups, families, religious groups, social groups, political groups, work groups, etc. And these groups also have their own internal as well as external dimensions, right? So in this way, you kind of already have a clue about what Ken Wilber's integral paradigm is all about. It's not new information to us, and yet I got inspired to apply this paradigm to ethics because even though we social workers know all of that stuff about individual, internal, external, group, internal, external, we still can get into some of the nastiest arguments about who is right and wrong about, shall we fill in the blank? Gay marriage, abortion. Well, come on, fill it, come on, don't be shy with me. Come on, fill it in. What are some of the things we get into nasty, and we're quick to say, that's unethical, right? So I have this really crazy idea that if we could really think and see integrally, then we would be able to have the kinds of conversations that are congruent with social work values and purposes. Not that we will always agree or even come to consensus, but seeing in this more complicated, nuanced way frees us up to actually engage authentically with each other rather than shutting down, self-censoring, or talking about each other behind each other's backs. Some of you know what I'm talking about, how that works in universities and agencies everywhere. What's more, I'm convinced that if we could actually authentically engage, really show up in these difficult conversations and not hide any of the dimensions of who we are from each other, then we'll be able to come up with responses that none of us would have come up with on our own or by ourselves. So, we need to go to the next one.
Hold on, Mary. Something happened.
Okay.
It wasn't him. The computer is updating.
Yeah, your computer automatically updates.
Okay, well, it's not a big deal.
It wasn't me. I'm sorry.
Okay, not a big deal. So the next slide was simply... it's not a big deal. The next slide was simply a definition of Ken Wilber's definition of the word integral, and it's a really big definition. We'll probably skip over it after it does that. What I wanted you to see out of the slide was some really interesting words that sound like social work. Inclusive, non-marginalizing, embracing. These are social work words and principles that really have meaning for us. And I think especially of people of faith, they have meaning for us. So then there was another slide, which apparently is still not there. That's okay.
You'll be about 3 to 5 minutes from now. You can know when.
Okay. And we'll see. We have to be flexible about those things. Okay. So there was another slide that showed Ken Wilber's quadrants. And let me just hand this out while we're waiting on that, because I wanted to wait to hand out, as promised. There's a sort of picture that goes with this presentation. It's very colorful. Hopefully it will help simplify a very complicated... it is pretty... How many of you, let me ask while that's coming around, have read Ken Wilber, know who I'm talking about, the integral frame? Some of you? Okay. And the truth is, Ken Wilber is difficult to read. It's actually easier to read other people who've written about Ken Wilber than it is to read Ken Wilber. He's not amen partner right over there. Okay. And he's really difficult to read, and so that's why I try to put this into what I hope will be user-friendly format. So, now you're looking at that. So let's just go to that. Since you have that funny piece of paper in your hand, go ahead, pick it up. I'm actually going to give you a few moments just on your own, in your own way, to take it in. It actually represents centuries of thought as well as contemporary scholarship. And you could take whole classes, actually, on any number of its parts. But because we have now less than an hour to get a feel for all this and consider what it might mean for you and your teaching, I want you to just take a few moments with it. Feel it. Feel the paper. Let your eyes wander and light on whatever interests them. Take in all that you can in the many ways that you take in information with your logical, rational mind, with your intuition, your spirit, consciousness. All the many ways that we take in information. You may be able to get more doing this than anything I may say. I actually believe that, which is why I'm giving you this time. I trust that. In a moment, we'll begin talking about it. Still not up. That's okay. It says 32% now. We're making progress, aren't we? Okay. Very simply, Wilber's paradigm. Oh, you have a question.
I've been wrapping my brain around it, but I don't. And you're probably going to get to it. What is interiority and exteriority?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Good.
We're going to go there. So, the basic four dimensions are individual, sort of in the north and south, and interiority and exteriority as the east and west kind of poles. And we're going to talk about why I put some other words there. But those are, in Wilbur's thing, which I was going to show you, he sort of uses just straight lines and a quadrant. And what I found not so helpful about that is that it actually didn't show as much of the interconnectedness and dependence on each other. Looks like we're almost going to have this stuff again, which we can click really through that. But to give you a quick short answer, interiority has to do with the fact that each of us as individuals have interior processes and interior ways of knowing, like intuition, our feelings, our beliefs, our convictions. This is a different kind of way of knowing than exteriority ways, like looking at evidence and facts and what is considered objectively true.
And that can be individual or collective.
And both of those can be individual and collective, which is why this gets kind of complicated and heavy. So you can interrupt me, by the way, as we go. You guys, I can tell you're looking up there, and I see all these looks like you're going, it's not there yet. So I'm going to keep going because our time is so short, and I do want to honor and get us out of here on time. So let's first talk about the objective and subjective realities. So when I say the word objective, which refers to everything on the right half of your diagram that you have there. And if you want to go to the next couple, Jay. Go. Okay, so let's talk about this one. So this is what Ken Wilber's thing looks like. This is the sort of objective material body, including the brain. Anything that you can see, touch, or observe scientifically in terms of time and space. That's what we're talking about. And he calls this objective side it. Okay, and this is the collective objective side, which he calls interobjective. This has to do with systems, networks, technologies, government, and so forth. He calls that it. You will notice from the handout I gave you that I put the words external results, because this is what we're really talking about. Results, outcome, impact. And if you are a researcher, words like positivist might come to mind, because this is that paradigm where what's real is what we can measure and test and observe, right? And because we have consensus about how to measure these things, we call this fact. It may not be any more fact than the interior stuff, but we call it that because we have consensus about how to measure these things. All right. And on the other side, since we have this one up here, this half is considered the subjective side. And in terms of the individual, we have the word I. I didn't put that on your hand. You can add that to yours if you want. I was trying not to make it too busy. There's a lot we could put here. But look at thoughts, emotions, memories, states of mind, perceptions. I would add beliefs, convictions. You know, those are all subjective, interior ways of knowing. And for the collective, for the group subjective, we have shared values or beliefs. We have meanings, language, relationships, all that stuff. And Wilbur calls that intersubjective. As you know, the study of ethics is about what's good, bad, right, wrong, moral, immoral, and is about both process, what goes on inside people, and results, what happens on the outside, right? It's not either or, it's always about both. And as this name suggests, and Wilbur's paradigm suggests, all of these are integral. That is, they're all connected, and we can't actually separate them from each other. Even though, here's the point I want to pause shortly and give you a chance to think about, usually we develop preferences, experiential preferences for one half or the other.
I'm going to give you a moment to consider. Is your dominant hand, so to speak, exterior or interior? And is your dominant hand more individual or collective? We all have two hands, but usually we use one more than the other. That's all that means. And yet they're integrally connected in your body in much the same way. So maybe you can go to the next slide for a second. So I've added, and here's where we'll get into, there are actually whole schools of ethical thought that correspond to this individual, collective, and internal, external emphasis. We have on this side consequentialist ethics or utilitarian ethics. I use the word utilitarian on yours, which focus on, as the word suggests, consequences, impact. We have deontological ethics. We'll talk more about what each of these means. And I've added two schools of ethics that are gaining more attention in social work, care ethics and virtue ethics, that I think you'll find of interest as social work educators. So, next. As you contemplate your own ethical orientation, you might discover that you're more interiorly oriented, right? Or you may discover that you're more exteriorly oriented. Here are a couple of questions that might help you discern. I like the word discern. It's a spiritual term that hopefully we're comfortable with. Where am I most comfortable functioning most of the time? In the interior world of ideas and thoughts and beliefs and emotions and intuitions, or in the exterior world of sensory perceptions, outcomes, results, behaviors, things that can be measured. Where am I most comfortable most of the time?
Does it have to be either or?
Well, only for purposes of this sort of, where am I more dominant in terms of my hand uses? It's not either or, which is the point of integral. You do have two hands. So that's the given. But it is an interesting starting point to ask, where, if I had to pick, would I say I probably lean a little more toward that one or this one?
He's arguing for ambidextrous.
Well, he is. And there may be some of you who might be, but I start there with students a lot too, just for, if nothing else, so that we understand the concepts and the principles, and then we can get into, maybe I really am ambidextrous, but do you see what I mean there? So I'm not suggesting that you have to be one or the other. It's not either or. The point of this is that it is integral.
It's where you lean.
Yes, it has to do with a leaning. And most of us, because of our own life experiences, tend to lean one way or the other. For example, now I'm going to go out on a limb here. In this culture we live in, the U.S., it's really difficult because of the dominant influence of this culture not to be very individually oriented. Because individualism is so... Some of you, however, are more on that lower, the bottom half, because of maybe families or religion or something else, you see. But I would say in our culture, this is just for starters, I think our culture tends toward, right now, utilitarianism, consequentialism, results, impact. And we train people to be more oriented to outcomes, what actually happens, than to pay as much attention to the interior life, the interior things that are harder to measure, but are just as real to many people. It's not that we say they're not real, but it's that question of emphasis, what we're comfortable with, and where we're comfortable functioning. And then I asked you this question here, and if you don't play cards, you might wonder what you're talking about. But this is old card play terminology. So when you're in a pinch, even, and you have to make a choice between individual and collective, which one trumps most of the time in your experience? Or if it's kind of even for you with external and internal, which one would trump it for you? All I'm doing now is asking you to take a moment and see, because what we're going to do next is go through the schools of thought, and that will help you maybe determine even better where some of your leanings may lie. But just with hearing just that little bit, often it's better to react first to a little bit, and say, so can you come up with a basic leaning this way or this way, and then to individual or collect, just based on your intuition or whatever else you know about yourself? This is a question.
The spiritual aspect, you see that as internal?
I would. I do. And it makes me have this question whether people of faith would more naturally be more on the left-hand side. But I don't know that that's true, actually.
I would argue that might be the case. It depends on where the strength of your faith is that way.
Clearly.
I think that some people, it's really the foundation of their being, their existence. And for me, that's kind of where I would be coming from. I would be very tempted to go to the results and whatever. Something you see, that's the external. My thoughts.
Yes, please.
Look, on the other hand, if God is your external authority, then it's not
external. Then there's another way to look at that, right? Yeah. This is why I was going to ask this question to this group. So you kind of started us in that direction already.
Yeah, I would say different faith traditions tend to emphasize different pieces. So some faith traditions say, how do you know what you believe? By your fruits, you will know them. Much more externally
driven.
Whereas more mystical approaches would much more the internal. So different faith traditions tend to emphasize.
And in even different, let's say, denominations within the same tradition.
Yes.
Or sects.
Yeah.
Wow. See how complicated it is? This is why people don't read Ken Wilber or try to talk about this. You're doing a very good job already of keeping up. So the reason I start here with some preliminary discernment of where you think you might be most comfortable most of the time is because I think, here's another one of my premises, I like to be transparent about this. I think it's important for us to understand our basic orientation so that we don't automatically judge those who are differently oriented as automatically unethical. And I can't tell you how many times I hear people just arbitrarily, well, that's unethical, or less sophisticatedly, well, that's stupid. What we're saying is because I'm this way and you're that way, it's bad. And if we can just loosen that up a little and say, okay, I know that I tend more this way, and I will come across students and colleagues who are more that way. This begins our process of being able to really, this is my whole thing with diversity is, you know, it's just a game, and we're just faking it if we can't really appreciate these differences. So this can actually help us move there. Are you going to say something?
No, I'm just...
Okay.
You're in an awesome spot right now.
She's in an awesome spot. So let's do what I want to call a cursory overview of the orientations. And let's start on the deontological side, since I went the other way before. Deontological ethics. Usually the person of Immanuel Kant comes up. He's a big name. And when you read about ethics, and so one of the things I want to say before I get started with this is you have to keep your eye on the ball. Ethics, again, what's good, bad, right, wrong, and these other words keep coming up. What's good, what's true, and what's beautiful. Those three words in the study of ethics come up a lot. So keep your eye on, with each of these schools of thought, where's the good, where's the truth, where's the beautiful. So in the deontological school, good is found in the interior process of obeying, obedience actually, to non-negotiable truth or absolute truth that is found in some principle. Now, it might be a religiously oriented principle like the Ten Commandments or Jesus' Golden Rule. It could be a secular principle. You know, there are secular people who are very deontologically oriented for different reasons than religious people are deontologically oriented. See, this is where it can get really confusing. So, even, here's what's important to remember, with the deontological school of ethics, and this is more individually based, even if the outcomes are not what we expected or prefer, and even if we're not trying to, even if we haven't executed the rule or the principle perfectly, the pure intention or motivation of trying to obey, trying to be true to the principle is what counts. That's what's good. It's why the words intention and motivation are on that side. So you could say the truth is found in the principles themselves and in the intention or motivation to obey them. And as I've said, these principles can have theological, religious origins, or they can have secular origins, like the code of ethics. You know, there are some people very deontological about the social work code of ethics. They are. But regardless of the situation or the anticipated outcome, the thing to do is to stand with the principle. Is what deontological ethical school of reasoning is all about. That's our duty. And deontological ethics are all about duty. So just two quick examples. One religious, has a religious orientation, one more secular. So the senator last year, I think it was, who said with great pain that he had searched his heart and he could not agree that abortion, even in the case of a rape, was acceptable. And I watched, did any of you know who I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
He lost his job mm-hmm. over this. See, it wasn't about the consequence of whether people would like him or agree with him or not. He had to stand with that principle. And I had some students in class, you know, oh, that's just stupid. And I said, well, now, it sounds to me like you're being deontological about, you're being as deontological as you are saying he is. And this led to a very interesting conversation because we've gone through this. And she, this student who called him stupid, actually got in touch with how she said, I recognize that in this conversation at family dinners, I often do the same thing with my grandfather, who I just disagree with what he believes, and I think he's stupid. But then I'm doing the same thing that I am accusing him of. Because I have a principle that's different than his principle. Okay. The other example I wanted to give you, sort of on the other side of this, was an Iowa Supreme Court justice that lost her job over gay marriage. As if she was a good Catholic from Iowa. She later confessed, and I read about this with some interest, that she didn't really even understand gay rights all that much. But here's the thing. She had a deontological orientation with the principle due process. And she couldn't understand why we should deny due process to this group of people. She was as deontological, do you get what I'm saying, about due process as a lawyer, as a judge. And even though she was Catholic and she had all these people sort of doing this yay, yay, gay rights, and then they saw her as a gay rights activist, and she was sort of, no, not really. And she lost her job. Just like the senator lost his job. They voted her out after Iowa passed the gay marriage law. Just want you to know. So, you see what I mean by what deontological means? All right. Go to the other side. The utilitarian or consequentialist school of ethics. John Stuart Mill is the classic name that comes up on this side. He suggested, and those who follow this school of reasoning, that it's not the motive or intention or the principle that determines whether something is good or ethical. What determines the good, the true, the beautiful is what actually happens. What's the outcome? Is the outcome positive, good? That still has a judgment to it, clearly, right? But still, it's the outcome. What actually happened? So you could say this school of ethics is about calculating the consequence, what some people of faith might call counting the cost. If results are positive, then my decision was ethical. If the results are negative, then maybe my decision was wrong. Achieving the desired outcome, that's what's good in this school. Now, as you know, this line of reasoning is sort of the ends justify the means way of thinking. And this kind of reasoning has been used to justify a lot of medical research that years later we've said, not so cool now, you know, you think about, denying black men penicillin when we knew that it existed and would, you know, keep them from dying. But we thought the ends of learning about syphilis, that justified that. Okay. Shall we go on to the next school? Mm-hmm. Care ethics. Now, this theory of ethics, now this is on the right-hand side, the objective side in the collective realm. This theory of ethics is the newest theory, actually, of all of them on this sheet, developed by feminists. The names Carol Gilligan, Nell Noddings come up a lot in the second half of the 20th century. And it deviates from deontological and individually oriented consequentialist ethics in that it emphasizes the importance of relationships and emotion, as well as reason. It recognizes the interdependence of all individuals in achieving certain outcomes, you could say, or interests. And here's another emphasis of theirs that I think you'll recognize in our academic culture, that those who are most vulnerable to our choices and the outcomes of those choices deserve extra consideration. It also recognizes the necessity of attending to contextual details in any situation in order to actually safeguard and promote specific interests of those involved. So, you see why I put it on this side? Because it's contextually oriented rather than individually. And I put it on the right-hand side because it seems to me, as I watch and think about this stuff, it is more interested in outcomes and results than it is intention. Not that intention doesn't matter, but it seems to me, in terms of how we at least have applied it, that it tends to get a bit more of an external, objective orientation. A lot of times you see talk about unintended consequences of power imbalances, that sort of thing. And it's that side where I would put social work competencies, by the way. Competencies are what? Outcomes, results. As a collective, we have said now, social work education should be measured entirely in terms of outcomes, competencies. Right? We don't have the content areas that we used to have. We have now competencies. Those are standards, you could say, of care. And some would say reflect this sort of emphasis on care ethics. And although this, as a relatively new theory of ethics, is still in its early stage of development, it seems to me it's been very influential in IRBs. Some of you serve on IRBs, you know what I'm talking about. We're always looking at vulnerable populations. We have to have full board reviews and make sure that nothing could be construed as being even unintentionally coercive or oppressive or exploitative of vulnerable populations and so forth. So, and I brought as a very current example of this one, this is breaking news in St. Paul, Minneapolis, where I happen to live. Insider puts her church on trial. I don't know if the news has made it here. Another clergy misconduct, icky situation. This is a woman who actually had a dream job as a canon lawyer and reported child pornography on a priest's discarded computer. Now, why do I bring that up? the mere act of having child pornography, just possessing it, is considered abusive. And it's a crime in the state of Minnesota and in many other states. And you see why that's on this side? It's an outcome. We haven't looked at intention, motivation. The mere outcome of that is enough to say, well, she actually resigned her position. And shortly after that, the university where I teach, this came from our president Monday, it's an announcement saying that one of our professors in Catholic studies was named in a sexual abuse lawsuit. This is, you kind of want to go, okay, but, and it's like so timely with this. So look at, and our president sent this to everyone. She wanted us to know that he's been put on a leave of absence immediately just because he was named in the lawsuit. The investigation hasn't happened yet, but just because he was named, his classes are reassigned to other faculty. The university has zero tolerance, blah, blah, blah. You see the point of it? It's all, I think you can argue that from an ethics of care kind of orientation. Finally, this is getting pretty long and boring, right? Can we go to virtue ethics? Any questions so far? So virtue ethics is on the other side of the collective half. And this school of ethics goes all the way back, and maybe further, but at least to Plato and Aristotle. And it's gaining more attention in social work and around the world, and there are some references to this on the yellow sheet. If you didn't get a yellow sheet, by the way, some of you came in a little later, make sure you get that. That's sort of just the overview, and it's got more references for those of you who want them. But now listen to the difference. Where is good and beauty or truth found in a virtue ethics framework? Check this out. It's not found in the outcome. It's not found in the intention in the individual. It's found in the enduring virtues or character. You could say the dispositions of people. That's where beauty and good and truth are found. They are in these qualities or virtues of the person. So one of the questions I have had is, was Jesus a virtue ethics person? Or was he integral? Or was he, well, you know, but I'll leave that for you to think about. But why am I mentioning this? It hasn't been a school of ethics that we've, a form of ethics that we've even talked about much in social work education. But there are more and more people writing about it. Because it's true that professions like social work and medicine and law, we identify virtues that we think are important for our practitioners to have, right? Like prudence, beneficence, justice. There was a presentation earlier on gratitude as a virtue, and I think it definitely is one we could have a lot more conversation about, for example. But some are concerned that as we emphasize so much either following a rule or getting an outcome, we miss the boat in terms of, are we really developing the kind of people we want to be practicing social work? Are they virtuous people? Do you get the difference? It's hard to measure. And you see why it's on the left side, because there is a moral duty, you could say. There's a disposition to do the right thing, but it's because, like, take lying. A virtuous person doesn't lie because that's breaking a rule or because they're afraid of the consequence. They don't lie because they don't want to be the kind of person that lies. Do you see the difference in that? It's inconsistent with who they are. And why is this important, potentially, in social work? Some of the people who've been writing about this talk about when we can at least include some orientation to virtue ethics, people are then free to act creatively and responsibly and freely, rather than being reduced to simply following a rule or thinking about the risk or the consequence as though that's all there is. Okay, there's lots more I could say. I think I need to pause now and say, up to this point, questions, comments. This is sort of, like I said, centuries of thought in, you know, a few minutes. And I know it's fast and dirty, but do you have, having heard this, even a sense of your leaning left or right? And that doesn't have to be political, by the way, or religious. But do you have a sense of whether you lean more towards consequentialism, deontological ethics, care ethics, virtue ethics? Why don't you hit the next one there? I ask students these questions because the premise here is that we both, all of us have two hands and we're not either or, just like this gentleman said. So then we can get even more specific with our questions. When and under what circumstances am I more deontological? So students point out, well, in certain contexts, I find that I'm clearly deontological. But in other situations, I may be more consequential. Okay? When and under what circumstances am I more utilitarian? And then some of us may have particular hot-button issues, certain kinds of results or consequences that actually would trump for us whatever the intention was matters less than the fact that that happened. You with me? When and under what circumstances am I more individualistic or individually oriented? And students and faculty, if we're asked, I'm going to give you some time to think about this too, and I'll be quiet for at least a minute. When and under what circumstances am I more contextually sensitive, open to breaking a rule for a good reason? I think about Jesus who healed on the Sabbath. Why did he do that? It wasn't because he wasn't a good Jew, didn't know the law, and didn't honor the law, right?
Huh? Well, he replaced law.
Well, but that's what we've said since him, but he didn't have that. You know, he didn't go to that church, right? So, okay, so he was in the other church. And then we made that, we created all that after him. But you have to say, so, or when he threw out the money changers, he just went in there and...
He raised Cain.
Yes, he did. Was he being more consequentialist then because he said, you're making my house a den of thieves? Or was he being more deontological? Anyway, I'm going to let you ponder that. But take another minute or two. Ask yourselves. See if these questions help you get any clearer about your leanings, your left-handedness, your right-handedness. And let me be quiet for just a moment. Let you do that. How are we doing on time? How much time?
You've got plenty of time.
15 minutes
for questions.
Perfect. So while you're discerning, I'm going to do a little more. and we're going to discuss and then come back to things. So see if you can take some time with these questions.
Thank you.
So what's the point of all this? But first, comments on anything you thought of, what you want to say.
In teaching ethics to my students, I've learned to explore with them another ethical perspective, situation ethics.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, kind of based upon the level of all your heart and mind, sort of loving you to ask yourself.
Yeah.
And looking at how can you interrogate a situation and make a decision that is more loving. Now,
so is that virtue or is it consequential?
Well, well, yeah. You know, at one point, you know, it didn't gain much traction. But, you know, there was that particular school, but it kind of falls maybe on the virtue and the care side.
Mm-hmm. On the collective end.
Yeah, I
think so.
A combination of both.
It does sound like it. The way you taught it, I've heard situation ethics taught very consequentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It, to me, it kind of integrates all of them, but again, you know, looking at the context, looking at the principle of love.
Yeah, which is, would be the virtue.
Virtue.
Love would be the loving thing to do.
How sometimes one has to break the rule.
Break the rule, in order. That's why I think Jesus healed on the Sabbath.
Trump.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you play cards too? All right. Okay. Never mind. I have to be careful about saying certain things, Rick. What else? Come on. Thank you. What other thoughts, reactions, just at this point, please? We've had time. What's bubbling up?
Do you not set up the student by asking the question this way?
This sort of trying to discern
when and under what understanding, rather than do you, if.
Yeah.
That makes an assumption that these things do happen.
It's true.
And I think that's a faulty assumption, that it has to happen.
Yeah, and usually I say that, but I think you're right. I think what happens, though, if we just do it the other way, and I try to say why I do it this way, so that's my only, you could say, saving grace, if there is one, is I think what happens if we don't force some of this kind of reflection, we just say, well, I just integrate it all. And I'm always integral. I don't think we're always integral. I don't think that's honest. I don't think it's accurate. And how do we get at the difficult stuff? And it seems to me, and so I try to hold this really big container and say, I'm not trying to put you in a box. That's really not what I'm trying to do. But what I'm trying to do is get you to, first of all, just be honest about where you think you might be this or that. And I sort of try to say it like that. But this is a really good observation, because you're saying, if I were really integral, maybe I wouldn't even say this. But then I don't know how to, in doing
that's
that, get them to sort of appreciate the complexity and how these different ways of reasoning our way through difficulty are really different. They are very different ways of thinking and being oriented to the world. Please.
Well, it's interesting. I kind of want the converse, like the when and under what circumstances, because when I started out, I strongly identified with one quadrant. And I'm like, oh, I'm always that.
Really?
But then, I strongly identified, like, oh, I know where I'm at. And then I started looking back, and I started, like, when and under what circumstances, am I this way or that way? And I looked, and I was like, two instances from my career when I was, you know, different jobs and different things, there are two situations that I still think about, did I do the right thing or not?
Yes. Uh-huh.
When I was sitting in another part of the quadrant.
Yes. Often when we're in our uncomfortable quadrant, we feel really vulnerable.
Yeah,
and I still don't know,
part of me is like, glad I did what I did, part of me is not, but both of them were gut decisions.
Uh-huh.
And so it was interesting, under what circumstances did I gut go to here, and did my gut go there? And it's important.
And you trusted your gut
that.
And went with it.
Well, I went with it at the time, because I didn't have much time to think about it. But you need to know what are you going to do.
Yes.
Where's your gut going to go when you're in certain situations?
That's right. And I say something kind of like that to students. It's like, this is why we're doing this. Yes. Thank you.
Think about my question. I realize that I'm utilitarian. Because my question really was, is the goal of all this, because I'm guessing most of us are in one of these camps at various times of the day.
At various times of the day.
Is the goal of this like mindfulness, to be aware in a heated conversation of where I'm coming from,
where they're coming from,
and then to realize that we're not really just talking about the topic, but we're also coming at it from different points of view in the way that we have viewed the topic. And then if we change the way we view the topic, we'll have a way of talking together.
Is that it? Yeah. Oh, Lisa's going, is that it? I love Lisa. And you sound like an interesting mix, by the way. I do hear the clear utilitarian sort of aspect of your question, but I also hear the other side. It's a little bit more muted, but... let's have the next slide. The point is that, and I hope you can see it from this, that there is good and truth and beauty in all of them. So, for example, even if I'm more deontologically oriented or virtue oriented, if I ignore results and consequences, outcomes to people, really? I mean, I'm actually leaving out something really important, right? If I say the other side, as you just did, I'm way more utilitarian. But if I forget that there are also motivations and intentions and that those also matter, I'm leaving out something really important too, aren't I? So part of my point in doing this is to get us and our students to be able to see all of it. And then here's the question that comes up a lot. Well, then everything is relative. You know, that's sort of relativistic, and everything is relative. And then here's what I argue with those who get cynical about relativism, which I understand. The reason we get cynical, I think people think about it, is because the presumption is if everything is relative, then nothing matters. I think maybe there is a lot of relativity, but that means everything matters. It's not that nothing matters, it's that it all matters. That's what I think the point of this is. And to get us somehow to wrap ourselves around the whole, the all of it that matters. And that will challenge us when we're in our non-dominant mode, and we will feel more vulnerable and less secure. But if I'm conscious of that, then when I see someone else operating from that perspective, how am I more apt to engage with that now that I have this awareness, now that I have this experience with myself? I'm hoping with more genuine empathy and compassion, I don't have to fake it or just say what's politically correct. I can actually mean it because I know I've been there. I've had that struggle. Anyway, what else? Please, wait a minute.
Just a quick thought as I'm thinking about all of this. If we're trying to follow what we believe as Christians and what we see in the Bible and apply it based on biblical perspective, biblical truth, that's a very deontological stance.
Mm-hmm. Either deontological or virtue, one or the other. But it's clearly on that half of them. Yeah.
Right. And so with that, how do we then account for all of the exceptions? And even just, you know, us making the exceptions. I mean, as you said yourself, Jesus was all about the exception.
He talked to women. He wasn't supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. He wasn't supposed to deal with Samaritans. Jews weren't supposed to why did he make those exceptions? It's a very good question.
It kind of leaves us in this place where we want to know the ultimate way and right way to do something, even in our faith practice, without a compass, even in the Bible, you know? And it makes me a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm hearing you with my good ear.
Anybody else hear that and want to respond?
Yeah.
It's a really wonderful observation.
I think we're always in kind of struggle because the Apostle Paul talked about his struggle.
Yeah, the good that I want to do, I don't do. And
there's always that tension of ethical decision making. It's not always a clear path.
Yeah.
But there is that kind of struggle, even struggle to make between all four quadrants at times.
That's right.
Trying to make a decision.
That's right.
About a specific situation.
Yes.
We have to call upon our virtues, upon care,
yes.
upon principles, upon outcome.
That's right.
And that's kind of tough. It's not messy. It's messy. It's not as
it's clean. Messy.
Not as clean cut.
It's messy. If we're honest, it's messy. We may not like it. We may not want it to be messy. Mm-hmm.
And I think when you hear Paul say things like, now we only see through a glass darkly, I think an honest recognition of our human condition is part of what compels us to go deeper. I mean, we've all been to introductory ethics classes. You get your list of rules you don't break, and you don't break them because if you do, you could lose your license. That's ethics.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's such a shallow understanding in our human condition, even as people of faith, especially as people of faith and humility. We recognize we need counterbalances. We need to know what are the consequences to help balance. Are we understanding these deontological rules appropriately? And most of all, are we becoming the kind of people
yes.
that are acting in ways that are going to be bring value and the things that we want to bring to our clients? And if we ever think we only need one of those areas, we think we're seeing through the glass cleanly, but we're not. And we have the hope that will, day will come. But until it comes, let's check some balance with all. So I appreciate you inviting us to a deeper level of ethics that recognizes we're never going to get it all exactly right. But these checks and balances can help keep us more on course. So I think it's a wonderful invitation to the human condition driving us to be a lot more careful than just memorizing rules and trying to follow them. Good for you, Mary.
Yay! Yay! What was this back here? Oh, that's my sign. Anybody else? I see a few other people that are trying to get in, and I know we only got a couple of minutes, and you will let me finish this up, won't you? So this was all of the stuff that I thought mattered here, and I did have one little song to end with that I thought might bring this all together. So this is very complicated and messy, isn't it? And so, again, I think the point is to see all this complexity without getting overwhelmed, anxious, or depressed. Because there's no need to, really. Being oriented to consequences, individual and collective, is important. Because they're important. But being exclusively that can keep us so future-oriented. See, when you're always thinking about consequences, you're really in the future. And when you're oriented this way, you're often looking back. And here's the real deal. The middle, the center, the very point where it all comes together in the middle, you could say is the present. That's where we live. And that's where we, you could say, have impact, intention, and all of it. And so I would say that the whole point of this model is to see all of this, and I use the word recognize, recognize, look again, and see our students and ourselves, see them and us, and that at this tiny point in the center, that's where it all comes together, is in the present, in this place I call the holy, H-O-L-Y, and W-H-O-L-L-Y, the holy now. And Pete Mayer, who's a Minnesota composer, songwriter, has written a beautiful song called Holy Now. And if you'll bear with me, I think I can do it.
You need to try to move that over so that's not your face.
Oh, thank you, darling. When I was a boy each week, Sunday we would go to church, pay attention to the priest, and he would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. And I remember in Sunday school, we would read about the time Jesus, Moses split the sea in two. You know I know that. And Jesus made the water wide. And I remember feeling sad. Miracles don't happen still. But now I can't keep track. Cause everything's a miracle. Everything, everything, everything's a miracle. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So you see, the challenging thing becomes not to find the miracle, but finding where there isn't one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When holy water was rare at best, I used to wet my fingertips. Now I have to hold my breath like I'm swimming in the sea of it. This used to be a world half there, heaven's second-rate hand-me-downs. Now I walk it with reverence and care, cause everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Read a questioning child's face and say it's not a testament. Well, that'd be very hard to say. Or see another new morning come, say it's not a sacrament. I tell you, it can't be done. This morning outside I stood, saw a little red-winged bird shining like a burning bush and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things had changed since then. Cause everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. I think we should end it there.
Yeah.